Hey, everybody. Before we get started, I wanted to bring your attention to my best friend Dan has a cat named Skeeter who has FIP, which is a very upsetting disease for your cat to have. And he's trying to raise money for the experimental drugs for it that are quite expensive. So if you go to bit.ly/save Skeeter, that's bit.ly/SAVESKEETER, you can help raise money for them to pay for their cat's medicine to keep her alive. So it would really mean a great deal to me if you did that. So please check that out, bit.ly/SaveSkeeter. And now, on with the show. I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. A Place for My Stuff, the artist George Carlin. My guest this week is Ian Brody. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. How are you doing?
I am good. Now, we'll talk about why you picked this album in a moment, but let's talk a bit about your book. I don't always do this up top, but I am curious about your book, A Vulgar Art, A New Approach to Stand-Up Comedy. Tell me what the book is about, why you wrote it, etc.
Well, the book came out of my doctoral dissertation. I am a folklorist, which is a very weird thing. Because when you drop that term, people sort of expect you to be somewhere out in the woods and, you know, banging drums together. Really just looking at old timey stuff. Yeah. And there are many folklorists who do that. And every now and then I have to do that. And that's completely fine. But as folklore as a discipline has been around for the better part of 70 years now, sort of a post-war thing. And really, it emerged from being this, it has its origins in being this retrieval of old stuff and mm-hmm. bringing it forward, to recognizing that the things that we now treasure about the past, those kind of creative acts like story, like song, we still do today in the same kind of format. So the study of folklore has kind of shifted from looking at these things as items and, mm-hmm. and the results, just these texts, to looking at them as the consequences of certain kinds of performance contexts.
Okay.
We get together, we hang out, and we engage in some kind of expressive form. Even if we're not necessarily thinking of it as I am engaging in an expressive form. Sure. I am about to tell you a story. We do it anyway, because we shape our ways according to the expectations of our group.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, when I was hunting around for a topic for my dissertation, I had noticed, I'd always been a fan of stand-up comedy, and we'll talk about that a little bit, but one of the first things I came across was African-American toasts, and mm-hmm. Those like long-form poems, and that was just introduced into a sort of folk literature course that I was taking. And I said, that's an awful lot like Rudy Ray Moore's Dolomite stuff,
sure,
isn't it? It's like, so cool. And like, I think I might have a topic here. And then the topic sort of had that very basic, let's look at how comedians will sometimes engage in these classical folklore forms. And that's, you could do that. You could do Andrew Dice Clay's use of nursery rhymes.
Sure.
There is stuff. And then as sort of I got more into the discipline, the idea of, well, no, let's look at these as contexts. Let's look at these as stand-ups are basically doing the same thing that you and I would be doing in informal talk. And it happens, manifested differently, but basically happens all over the world. And that we gather together for no other purpose than, hanging out with each other. We probably have something in common. We probably have some kind of mutual obligation, mutual friendship, and so on. But we're not necessarily meeting for that purposes. This isn't a work site.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bar. It's around the kitchen table. It's wherever you're doing it. And we just start talking. And we talk because it's pleasurable, because it's fun, because it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of us might sort of get into a riff of some sort. And, and so we all kind of shift in our seats and we're looking at him and he's talking and he's like, not really monologuing, because he's really still talking with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's just we've let him take more control of this conversation. And so if you think of, like, so you can talk about That's small talk. That's bullshit. That's styling and profiling. I mean, there are numerous words for it. But basically, it's you're just letting the guy talk because he is amusing. And we're just, let's just give him some things. And, you know, he needs to stay. I'm using gender terminology, sorry. But sure. They need to stay amusing as they go on. And then eventually they end and they kind of go back. And then you start talking. And I shift my attention towards you. It's kind of back and forth. And I think that's where a lot of the baseline of stand-up kind of emerges. It's fun, small talk. It's important because it is about communication and about sort of reaffirming the crowd to itself. It's also, you know, dig me, as you know, Carlin would often say. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of attention getting. But then stand-up takes that and transports it into a different sphere. Most importantly, you start doing it in front of strangers. And you do it where you don't necessarily have this common bond with people. You don't necessarily have these sense of obligation. So it's moving outside of that classic idea of a folk group into just something one order larger. Mm-hmm. And then it might take place in a thing where it's not kitchen table, where the distinction between performer and audience is really negotiated by nothing else than the way we pitch our bodies. But it's done on a stage where it's like, you're now performer, capital P performer. And we are now audience, capital A audience. And it just brings a different level of expectations. Yeah. Plus, then you have economics where like the audience is paying for this. So they better fucking deliver.
Sure.
And that changes it. So you're now dealing with people that you have a different relationship with in terms of what their expectation of performance is in terms of the quality. Mm-hmm. Because when we're sitting around the table and if you're boring, that's fine. It's just like, Jason, that's fine. Okay, now mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. If it's on a stage, it's on a comedy club or something, it's like, I paid for this. You better be good.
Yeah.
And then you're moving outside of your town. So it's not even you have like these remote ideas. You're now talking in front of strangers. You might be mm-hmm. on the circuit. You might be differently embodied. It's like, I'm a white comedian and I'm in front of a black crowd. How do I negotiate this? It might be regional. It might mm-hmm. be whatever. And then once you have recordings, once you have broadcasts, you're not even present to the people that you are speaking to, because now you have the idea of these two audiences. Stand-up, as you know, always has someone in front of to talk to. It's a collaborative form. As I said, it's a conversation where we've ceded most of the control over to the first person, mm-hmm. but it's still dialogue. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work without an audience response. And you see that when you read things like brain droppings or sign language or Rock This or Ellen's books or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you see when routines are put onto the page, they have to be rewritten because things that are like, monumentally offensive that the audience says, ha 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 ha, that's okay, and really completes that semantic circle. It's mm-hmm. like you have made a joke and not a terrible statement.
Yeah.
You don't have the benefit of the audience on the page.
Sure, yeah.
So they need to put in these little things. Like an example that I go back to is there's a Chris Rock routine. It's from his HBO Half Hour. And it's, I met a woman, she said she doesn't date black men. I said, why you don't date black men? No reason. So I punched her in the face. Now she has a reason. I'm doing an injustice to the delivery. But the audience goes nuts. The audience, that is a funny thing. When it's in paragraph form in Rock This, he says, I'm just kidding. I would never hit a woman. But he has to introduce that because he has nothing else. He doesn't have the collective audience reassuring the reader that this is a cool guy, he's just making a joke and we know he's being naughty. So we see that. So it's a dialogue, as always. But when you go to a recording and vinyl and what we're sort of talking about today, you have this dual audience. So you need the audience present at the performance, but you know that for the most part you're trying to make it work for people who aren't in the room, who are not only distanced in terms of I don't know your I can make educated guesses, but I don't know about your socioeconomic background. I might have an audience, but I don't know who you are. And not only that, I don't know when you're going to be listening to this.
Sure.
And presumably, I'm going to probably also want to make it work so you listen to it more than once.
Right.
You know, you want it to be a text. So what kind of decisions are being made when the comedian commits something to recording, to yeah. record, to broadcast? And those are the kind of things I'm interested in.
What's interesting to me is the first thing that struck me is talking about the origins of it as, let's say, a group of people around a table or just around a fire, whatever the hell. The group of people talking and then one person takes control of it. There are a few things that obviously change. Number one, obviously, the audience is there. But in order to relate to a bunch of people, as you say, that you don't know or who don't really know you as who you are, the argument now is like, well, especially in the early years of podcasts, especially like when I started out, all comics were talking about was like, yeah, you got to find your voice, man. I'm still trying to find my voice. But that finding your voice is also a way of synthesizing yourself down to what is essentially a character. So it makes this argument to me that that most, maybe all stand-up, is finding a character. So whether you go from a Mitch Hedberg, who is a clear character, who is an idea of a thing, to somebody like who seems more natural, like a Paul F. Tompkins, where you assume this is who this son of a gun actually is. It's all still character, because if you don't find that, if you don't find either an archetype or something about you that can be easily squeezed into this concept, it's harder, I think, to reach this audience that does not know you as a person.
I would push back on that just a little bit in terms of the word character.
Uh-huh.
I think one of the things that comedians need to do is establish a reputation for a particular thing, a particular level of competence, a particular level of perspective, which may involve a character.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that we want to treat this as a profession as much as it is an art form,
mm-hmm.
of course. And one of the things that comedians do is they cultivate this reputation. They go on things like podcasts or AM radio or whatever. They appear in movies. There's a lot of offstage work where they are still communicating to an audience the kind of thing that you could potentially expect when you come to a show or when mm-hmm. you watch a special or so on. And they have the benefit of now a tangible repertoire that someone can go back to that is cumulative.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, I hate to invoke his name, but one of the interesting things that Bill Cosby did over time
mm-hmm.
is, and Carlin did it less so, but Carlin's an incredibly private person in his recordings.
Sure.
But Cosby, obviously, he was a big filthy liar, but he used his own life and what knew.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he eventually, if you go to albums like his fourth or his fifth album, you can tell that he has this expectation that his audience already knows part of his backstory.
Sure.
So you are not going to see a comedian. You are going to see Bill Cosby. You are going to see Chris Rock. You're going to see Dave Chappelle. You're going to see Tig Notaro. You are going to see people that you already basically have a relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ways that I frame the exercise is that you are trying to imitate the same kind of intimate communication that takes place around people who know each other. I use intimate, sometimes it sort of sounds like, cooing, that isn't it. But people that you know, people that you are familiar with. And now you sort of reintroduce yourself. Some stranger comes into town and it's like, here's what you need to know about me in order to facilitate and gear you towards what you are going to potentially hear from me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that boils down to everything from the MC introduction at an open mic.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here he is, he's a crazy guy, he's the funniest Indian that you'll ever see, ba-da!
Mm-hmm.
And then there we go. To years and years and years of a career where like a Lewis Black or something, you just walk in and you know me, I have my audience.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a character, but it isn't a caricature.
Sure.
It is a worldview that is communicated that you can now immediately hit the stage and like, I don't need to introduce myself. You know who I am.
Sure.
I'm like your best friend.
Yeah.
And like, there we go. So. Yeah. And that, I think, is the finding your voice and finding your audience are interrelated because your audience fills in the background. Your audience is your collaborator, and that's what you kind of need to do. So it's training an audience for how to be a good collaborator on stage.
Right.
Yeah, something like that.
The book obviously is about stand up as from your perspective and from your studies. But what I find interesting is that you did pick a record as a starting point that is also half or at least some percentage sketch. There's like pre-recorded stuff. So I want to know what made you think of this particular record. Why is this the one you picked?
Well, I think one of the reasons was that I had sort of a personal tie to it.
Okay.
It was a record that I don't have it anymore. It got lost somewhere in a move.
Sure.
But I had come across it when I was reasonably young. I was into Carlin. The moment I discovered Carlin was when my father had this very weird job for about a year. He worked for External Affairs, which is the Canadian version of like the State Department.
Okay.
As a non-rotationary officer, we never got to live overseas. He was basically in public the administration arm. Very boring. But for a year, one of his responsibilities in the early 1980s was helping to create entertainment packages for people who lived overseas. So if you lived in a place that didn't have English language broadcasting, or much of an English language broadcaster, they sent out the enormous early 80 like Panasonic Hitachi VHS machines, huge, those massive ones.
Sure.
That still had, if you wanted to time record, it still had a dial clock on it. Sure. So it's like the cheapest of alarm clocks. And then a whole library of video cassettes back when videos were like $150. He made the grand decision to do VHS and not beta. And then every couple of weeks in the diplomatic pouch, they would send out to each of the places six movies. There was like two children's movies, two general entertainment, and two adult, grown-up movies.
Sure.
And so he would be bringing out, well, first he had to bring home machines because we didn't have one because they were like $2,000 at the time. But then he finally bought one. Mm-hmm. So we were very early having VHS. And one of the things he brought home was Carlin at Carnegie.
Yeah.
And Carlin at Carnegie was a very early special that was released and I think produced with the intention of being released on home video.
Okay.
And so that's when I discovered Carlin. Mm-hmm. And then Place for My Stuff just emerged soon thereafter. But it's kind of an interesting wedge point in his career because Carlin at Carnegie is kind of like the beginning of something new.
Mm-hmm.
It's not his first special, I know, but it's his first special that has that is meant to be its own thing and not kind of an accident of touring. There's a lot more planning.
Sure.
Meanwhile, Place for My Stuff is kind of, I'll just say, all George Carlin albums are great.
Mm-hmm.
This is the worst George Carlin album. Is that fair? What?
I have a different perspective on it, which is funny. But it's all personal. This to me is the end of the era that I like. So, yeah, and it's fine. It is not his best material, but I don't like Angry Carlin that much. It never, ever attracted me.
But Angry Carlin didn't show up for four more albums.
Sure.
Angry Carlin didn't show up till What Am I Doing in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So for me, this is the middle of, people sort of talk about his three different careers. There's his pre-FMAN career, the 60s stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's that golden era, those three albums, the Carlin Gold, FMAN, mm-hmm. Class Clown, Occupation Fool. And then we start talking about and then Angry Carlin. But really, there is Goofy Shit Carlin.
Sure.
And that really extends more or less starting from Toledo Window Box and then going to, you can make an argument for side A of What Am I Doing in New Jersey.
Okay.
Where it's fine. It's fun. And I agree. I'm not a huge fan of Angry Carlin at all.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are very few jokes in there. I mean, he's just saying it's not even angry. It's bitter Carlin.
Sure.
I think it's I can see the craftsmanship in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not something I would put on to enjoy.
Right.
The Goofy Shit Carlin is kind of awesome, but it doesn't have the profundity of those first three albums.
He's, sure.
he's spinning his wheels in his biography and his autobiography. He's kind of spinning his wheels. But Carlin at Carnegie, Place for My Stuff was his first album in 5-6 years. It's the right. album where he is trying to get to grips with this. It's post heart attack. Mm-hmm. It's post one of his many bouts with rehab and Brenda's bouts with rehab and so on. He's in financial problems, and it's coming out of, he wants to do, he had stuck in this project, the Illustrated George Carlin, where he was going to do something that was kind of interesting, not much different from what Tig Notaro just did, mm-hmm. but it was going to be half stand-up special, and then it would slip over to animated vignettes of his stand-up. And that just blew through all his money, and it never really worked.
Yeah.
And this album was kind of an attempt to do that, to be sketch. And mm-hmm. the sketches are kind of awful. Do we agree?
They are fine at best.
Yeah, they're fine. He is a fantastic, and I think it's unimpeachable, even with Angry Carlin, he is mm-hmm. fantastic for writing for his voice on the stage.
Sure, yeah.
And as a writer, mm-hmm. he's, no. I mean, there's, it's a couple of good jokes, but that's not much different from the stuff that he had been doing on stage. That's a whole stage where he was doing that, and now time for the news, and mm-hmm. you sit down and read those like sort of funny headlines. It's like, yeah, okay.
The really funny thing is I'm listening to this and they're doing a bit, and at one point a lady's voice says, we'll be back to the album in just a moment, but first these mm-hmm. messages. I was listening to it on YouTube, and then they ran an actual ad right after that happened, which was the one unintended consequence of the internet is how much it ruins comedy albums.
Yeah.
The stand-up on this is preferable to any of the quote-unquote sketch.
Yeah, and the stand-up is, I mean, I think A Place for My Stuff, the routine,
mm-hmm.
is classic. I mean, I think that can go. And he used it again. He used it at the Comic Relief, and it was a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
That is, I think, a particularly brilliant piece of his. The other parts, they're fine. They're talking about food and Rice Krispies and a lot of stuff.
Right.
It is the first time, at least on record, that he does the that abortion routine.
Oh yeah, right.
And then that became the opening line of all his specials, starting at least in the late 80s. And mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great palate cleanser. Although I don't think anyone's coming to George Carlin not knowing that. I don't think there's many people whose monocles are falling off and pearls are being clutched when he says that. But still, it is a great intro line. But one of the things I'd be really interested in hearing your opinion of it, because you know this stuff so well, is this is also one of the first times that even though that you have those interruptions, things aren't tracked in the same way. Mm-hmm. His first albums were tracks. They've faded to silence,
sure.
and then they moved back.
Mm-hmm.
And these are interrupted by sketches, but every now and then there's two tracks on a CD or tracks on an album that nevertheless segue into each other. And mm-hmm. even in the sketches, there's bleed over into the sound sometimes.
Yeah. Right.
And I think that starts to be his initial foray into, or at least his first experiment in trying to have the hour, as it were, the beginnings of that context.
Right.
One of the things I love about Carlin, and again, my book had terrible timing. Mm-hmm. Because it came out in October of like 2014 or something. And mm-hmm. basically, there's a lot of the book, readers be warned, there's a lot of the book that says, isn't Bill Cosby fantastic?
Yeah.
And then it came out at the same time as all these allegations and subsequent more than allegations came out. I'm like, ugh.
Yeah.
But as a case study, if we can momentarily hold our noses, but mm-hmm. a case study, one of the things that Cosby did is, in addition to building on the idea that he was a known quality. So eventually he's talking about his family and his life and his celebrity as star of I Spy. And so his entire Warner canon, he goes from these little tracks that are like a few minutes old and sketches, the Noah sketch on his very mm-hmm. first ones,
mm-hmm.
to longer reflective pieces, things where he can talk for a minute or so without laughter, which is a remarkable amount of control.
Yeah, yeah.
To things like To Russell, My Brother, Who I Slept With, where it's a 25-minute routine.
Yeah.
And he's using the album. He's using the vinyl as a piece, which is, I think, one of the reasons that he's interesting to talk about, is that just like where jazz musicians were discovering that and what vinyl could do, mm-hmm. is that you weren't limited to the 3 or 5 minutes of a 78 or a 45. You were starting to have these expansive things where you could put 25 minutes uninterrupted. It's the same thing that led to, you know, fusion rock and Yes and mm-hmm. Pink Floyd and all those sorts of people. But it's like, okay, here's one thing. It's half an album. Here we go. 25 yeah. minutes. You couldn't have done that before. And you couldn't have necessarily expected your audience to put up with it. But right. it's like, all right, motherfuckers, I'm going to talk for 25 minutes and you're going to find it funny.
Yeah.
And it's going to be on, it's not simply going to be me on stage doing this. It's going to be something that you're going to bring into your home and you're going to listen to this 25 minute thing over and over again.
Yeah.
That's quite remarkable. Carlin, he's doing tracks again. But so if Cosby demonstrates the evolution of the comedy album into something, mm-hmm. Carlin demonstrates the evolution of thinking of the album and the vinyl album particularly as the primary medium
yeah.
to thinking of the special as the primary medium.
Sure.
So his first couple of specials, the one at USC, the one at Arizona, they're basically documentary films of his performances. They are much of that material you have seen on other, you've heard on his other albums.
Sure.
Carlin at Carnegie is kind of its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's predicated on the idea that he wanted to do that illustrated George Carlin. So think of it as a concert movie.
Sure, sure.
And then as you go after Carlin Carnegie and therefore after Place for My Stuff, you start to have things like Carlin on Campus and Playing with Your Head. And that is where the special and the album started to be recorded at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were still seen as distinct entities.
Yep.
There's a different edit that's in place.
Yep.
There's still, like on Campus, there's still a couple of weird sketches that he feels impelled to do, mm-hmm. like walking into a classroom and orating. And then eventually it's just like, no, okay, now I'm doing the hour where mm-hmm. I do this thing. It's going to be a live event on HBO. That is then going to also be a home video thing, mm-hmm. and it's going to be an album, one in the same. And eventually, you know, they all have the same titles up until, you know, Parental Advisory Explicit Lyrics is the same as the Back Again. I might be confusing the Back Again special, but then okay. eventually, it's just, these are all one in the same.
Yeah,
and that that's the transition that he, not alone, but he, because his reach was so big. And because his time frame is so big, he best exemplifies the transition from album to cable television and really the DVD more yeah. than anything, but certainly all that. So that's a really kind of interesting foray. And so oddly, I chose just this transitional album where it's just like he doesn't quite know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
He's got material, not enough for an album. He's still embedded in this, I'm going to be a writer. If you read the Playboy interview he did in 1982, he's kind of obsessed with writing, becoming a writer and doing movies.
Uh-huh.
It's just a sort of weird transitional moment. So, and yet there are still these moments of kind of glory.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
No, that's a good choice because I think in my brain I had sort of misappropriated it to a different transition, but this transition is one I don't think about that often, which actually I should because a lot of people who come on, especially people who are younger than me, and some of them not younger than me, have either never heard a comedy album or grew up more with TV specials than they did with albums.
Yeah.
And it is obviously a critical period where that's where everybody is getting their comedy. Even though everybody they're watching probably grew up with albums, which tends to be the case with the people I've interviewed who were doing comedy at that time when specials were the thing. Still are kind of the thing. I mean, you still want yeah. a special, but now it's on Netflix and mm-hmm. you hope somebody actually watches it. Yeah, yeah, this is an interesting, you know, I also noticed, I don't know if there's more than one, and I don't know if you know who this is, but there's a woman's voice on this record in the sketches. Do you have any idea?
I don't. I was looking for online liner notes.
Yeah.
I don't have, and again, I don't have an actual copy of the album to consult, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, well, I looked at the back of the album from what I could find online, because I guess I don't have it on vinyl anymore either, and she's not credited. There's no other person credited. I may have to ask Kelly Carlin to see if she knows. She might know, and if she doesn't, right, yeah. she's got access to the archive, which is I think it's at the American Comedy Center now, but somebody can answer that question. Maybe. Maybe.
I think so, yeah. I want to get, I've got this long-term project to access some of those archival things. And I've got a grant that I can now do it with, but there's a lot of stuff that I'd really be interested in with sort of deep, nerdy investigations into some of his recording.
There was a point, and it never came to fruition, unfortunately, just because of timing, where she was like, yeah, if you want to come see the archive at some point, let me know. And like, I know that she would just every once in a while just open up a box and like, oh, here's this set list from one of the nights on Johnny Carson, and just like just shit just piled in boxes. I would desperately have loved to see that stuff. Stuff is in there.
I mean, again, it's cliche, and I know that there are like 10 episodes of your podcast on Class Clown, but I mean, it kind of needs to be done. And I would have like sort of, oh, do me that. I'm not going to subject you to doing that again. But I had put in a proposal for, do you know that 33 and a third book series where they're like deep dives? Mm-hmm. They've never done a comedy album.
I know.
I wanted to do one on Class Clown.
That's a good one.
And because it was so sort of revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And I went to the Comedy Center once and just saw what they have on public display. And they had his calendar from early January 1971.
Whatever
year. And like all the dates, including the date of the recording itself. So it'd be like, I want all the set lists and any kind of recordings and any kind of like manuscripts of what was leading up to that and then what happened afterwards, and seeing, because Class Clown was obviously had an intent. It was going to be recorded. He knew that, and he was crystallizing. Mm-hmm. But he was probably still working the material to a certain extent up to that time. So are there any extant recordings that are just purely for his own purpose up to that point? How did the set list change? What was the set list that night? Because he tracked it. Mm-hmm. What order does he actually perform it in? And then what decisions are being made? And presumably there's a correspondence with producers. What decisions are being made when the actual album comes out?
That's a good point.
Decisions that, again, when you talk about all the decisions need to be made when you're talking about a live HBO special. Mm-hmm. And like, this is the order, but when you're tracking, it's a different thing. So I need to get into that. I think I might need to get a letter from Kelly saying I'm okay. And then,
That would be amazing. I pitched to the same company one about the First Family, but also they don't seem interested in comedy.
Not at all. But it would be a good project.
It would be. It would be. It's just like, I don't want to self-publish another fucking book, if I'm going to be honest. That's where I am. That's where I am right now.
So I know this is technically you interviewing me, but I'm interested. why vinyl, particularly for you?
So let me try and do the real answer rather than the post to justification, the post podcast justification answer, which is still legitimate. It's one of those, like, after looking inward, I realized this is why I had done it first. But the first comedy that I ever really like could memorize, because I could put it on repeat, was a cassette. So like, full disclosure, was a cassette. I've talked about it a million times. It's Billy Connolly's, The Pick of Billy Connolly, which is still fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
But then I started getting hooked when my mother gave me my grandmother's comedy records. She hadn't passed, but she just had lost her sense of humor. And so I was given all of her vinyl comedy records, and we had a turntable. And so I was just like, what the fuck is this? And I just put it on, listened to it with my friends, who I'm pretty sure I was subjecting to it. But there are a few things that we all legitimately got hooked on. And so that feeling of laughing with your friends, and that your friends still give a fuck about the thing you just presented them to, that was the most powerful thing in the world. And like, I made my best friend over comedy records, but it was on cassette. But then it got solidified with these vinyl, and nobody had done it because I started this podcast almost 11 years ago, and nobody cared. Nobody cared about vinyl. Nobody cared about comedy records. So I was like, well, I'll have a niche that apparently I didn't need, but it helped, I guess, a little. But yeah, that's why.
Yeah. Okay. Because I find it would be interesting to sort of do a nice broad survey of people's relationships with albums. Because if you read comedians' biographies, one of the things about albums is that, you know, on one hand, they are there to help solidify that reputation. I have a product I can sell. That's good. Mm-hmm. I have a product that you can listen to, and then you will get to know me better, so that when I come to your town, you're like, oh, it's this guy. Now, obviously that means I can't do that material anymore. I've got to do something else. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about what happens when you commit something to vinyl, or commit something to any kind of recording medium or broadcast, that you kind of have burned through it. But you also have it for comedians. You have it as this resource. And if you read their biographies, the amount of times that everyone from Steve Martin to Bernie Mac to Richard Pryor, they talk about sitting down and listening to albums over and over again. So they become, it's a really interesting question for me about why you would ever listen to a comedy album twice.
Sure.
Because, and this is where the audience, I think, comes back in that, you know, one of the basics of sort of humor theory is surprise, that something is unexpected.
Yeah.
And then when you have something that is obviously is expected because you know this material, what happens? Mm-hmm. In just go a little bit nerdy theory. That same question is asked in terms of why one reads detective fiction a second time.
Sure,
Or fantasy, because fantasy is basically what the hell is going
Absolutely,
on? What are the rules of this universe? And so structuralists will talk about, well, the first time you're reading it to experience it, and then the second time you're reading it to kind of suss it out and figure it out. Mm-hmm. I think that happens to a certain extent with comedy recordings. But the other thing is, because there's also this kind of collective experience of comedy, and you've probably been to a club where, because the audience was laughing, you laughed more than you might have at that comedian
Absolutely.
Otherwise.
Absolutely, every time.
In part because fellow feeling is, you know, psychic contagion, as they might call mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, that's also because of the nature of the sort of the social contract of being in a place, and that you help to encourage. You might laugh more just because this is a nice guy. Blah 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 blah. It's not inauthentic. It's mm-hmm. just not. It's just maybe a little bit heartier than you would a regular chocolate.
For sure.
With a comedy album, what I find interesting is that, as I said, you have these two audiences. You have the audience at home, and you have the audience who is there at the time. And the comedian is performing for both of those. Mm-hmm. So you in your den and whoever it was in that amphitheater. But as you are at home or listening, you mm-hmm. are always in the presence of fellow audience members who are hearing this for the first time.
Yeah.
So you kind of have this strange psychic contagion thing again, where it's like, I'm wrapped up. It's the audience that is selling this to me again. And I'm re-experiencing it as if for the first time.
Yeah.
So it's the event of it. It's not mm-hmm. simply the figuring out of the joke.
Right. No, it's a bit of dragon chasing for sure. It feels like. And that's a really good point, is the fact that audience, especially with a stand-up record, I could talk about sketch, but it's a totally separate issue from what you're talking about, which is absolutely right, is having that live audience really just it. And it helps, at least for me, helps me relive the first time I heard it in some new way. Because, again, like I said, dragon chasing, I could have just left it there. But yeah, it's absolutely right.
But one of the things I am interested in terms of you and vinyl and what you're talking mm-hmm. about with your friend, is that vinyl isn't portable.
Sure.
So, it would be interesting to sort of take a step back and see, well, what happened to comedy if cassette ever became the dominant media?
Sure.
I don't know, or 8-track for that little mm-hmm. period, but certainly mm-hmm. CD, where it starts to be less a thing that you have to be in a particular place.
Yeah, right.
When you had this cassette, was it in your car or your, or I guess you were a kid, but
yeah, I was a kid. The first cassette I listened
Walkman?
To no, my parents bought me a Walkman and I broke it immediately because I was a dumb kid. So I was listening to it on their stereo out loud, super inappropriate, and then playing it for my friend. And then when he and I met, he played for me Weird Al's in 3D, and we just sat there sitting in front of his stereo at home on his floor in his bedroom, just listening to Weird Al. Not stand up, but yeah, that was the first time, and it was just on a little personal stereo.
And again, without hyping vinyl too much, mm-hmm. It's an event.
Yeah, exactly.
It requires, and it can be a more collective event. But you know, when things are I sound like an old man, but when things are in your ears or when you're experiencing it and walking around or experiencing when driving, it's mm-hmm. just kind of this different level of engagement.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of odd. Now, good, because you don't have to be stuck in your living room.
Sure.
But.
Well, yeah. What I don't have when that happens, especially on the rare occasion I buy a comedy record digitally only or something, or do what I had to do today, which is listen to it on YouTube while I was doing other shit, taking notes about it specifically. I didn't have, not that you need this, but I didn't have the album cover to look at, which is informs every memory you have of that record from then on, at least for me. I'm very visual. So I'm always, if I'm listening to In 3D by Weird Al, I'm picturing the cover. I'm picturing the back cover. I'm picturing the liner notes, if that's the case. It's just a part of reliving the record for me.
Yeah, very mm-hmm. much so. Because it has substance mm-hmm. to it. And it's part of the, again, without trying to lay too much symbolism on it, it's part of the ritual.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, you listen to like Marc Maron and his obsession with vinyl, and yeah. he talks about that, like the taking it off the shelf and putting on the player. And
sure.
You just have this different level of intention. About
yeah,
it.
Absolutely.
And it's awesome that it's more convenient. It's awesome that you don't have to have access to a vinyl plant in order for your material to be out there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
What's the flip?
Well, exactly. And I mean, since starting this podcast, my goal this whole time has been get one of my own comedy records out on vinyl, and it has proven, you know, basically impossible because it's prohibitive, you know. And even though that is the dream, I want to have that own experience. I want to have that experience with my own record, or, you know, be nice.
Yeah,
it's very difficult.
Cool.
Yeah. Mark, by the way, if you're listening, you're not listening. You're welcome on the show. He's not going to do it. I've asked him 1,000 times. Who wouldn't want to? You know,
I would love to be on your show, Mark.
Yeah, exactly right. So this record is recorded in Vegas, which my brain just can't. There are certain artists I don't think of as Vegas people, but that's obviously like the pinnacle. Like, that's where you make the most money. But it's weird to me that that's where Carlin records this, is in Las Vegas.
But he was very much a Vegas comedian. I mean, a lot of his story is that you know, being fired from Vegas.
Yeah.
He was back there like a year and a half later. He just wasn't opening for who he was opening for, but it's sort of a seemingly incongruous verse.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, for most of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s, he would substantially, like 12 weeks a year, 16 mm-hmm. weeks a year in Vegas, because there's money to be made.
And sure.
He was very, if you read his interviews and you read his biography, he was very deliberate in his career. Mm-hmm. His decisions were very, they weren't crass commercial, but they were very concerned about paying bills and establishing. And you know, why shouldn't he be? I think we sort of reserve this kind of like madman artist role for the comedian. It's like, you know, people have intention and they have a purpose, and they're doing this, yes, because they have something to say, but yes, they also have responsibilities and mm-hmm. a legacy that they want to maintain, and that's what they're doing. So
yeah. It is interesting, too, when you're talking earlier about him, you know, having that desire to want to be more of a writer and maybe writing films. When I talked to Kelly, she was talking a lot about how he wanted to be more of an actor and get to act in more stuff. And he didn't have he just didn't have those opportunities until like way towards the end, like Dogma or whatever, but in small parts still. And it does make me, his sketches notwithstanding, I think I love watching him on camera. I love watching him in Dogma. I think he's a fun actor to watch. I would have liked to see what the rest of that career could have been. Mm-hmm. Especially right now. I mean, right now could have been a time he'd be doing Netflix specials for sure, but he might be getting offers to do movies on Netflix. It would, even as an old man, would have been nice to see.
Yeah.
You know?
That Playboy interview in the early 80s, which I sort of reread because it mm-hmm. comes out at the same time as this album. He's describing himself as not a good actor mm-hmm. at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then you read interviews with Kevin Smith or listen to him talk, and he says he was very concerned about the craft, and he would ask questions about the script to see if he had his characterization right. So, but is it because it was an unfulfilled thing?
Right.
Is it because it was childhood ambition that he didn't necessarily ever get to really enact too much?
Mm-hmm.
Like his sitcom work in the 60s and so on.
Sure.
Or was it was it purely mercenary? It's like, oh, what I really need. Did you ever watch his sitcom?
No.
Do you remember his sitcom at all? Yeah. It was, I mean, it was classic late 80s, early 90s,
right,
comedian. You know, what if I, instead of becoming a comedian, I had never left my neighborhood,
right,
thing. So,
yeah.
And it was fine, but it was, you know, he's still talking like this the whole time. They're doing sure. that kind of accent. And it's mm-hmm. like, oh, don't mind. And like, that's difficult to sustain for a season.
Right.
But yeah, his later, I think he did get better. But yeah, then that's a layman's opinion. But
sure. That's fine. I want to talk a little bit, this is a total side thing, but you knew I was going to ask about it. Since you're Canadian, we must talk about Canadian content since you're on the podcast. So tell me a little bit about experiences with opinions on, thoughts on Canadian content regulations.
There's two things to bear in mind, or two arguments at least that are going on side by side. There mm-hmm. is, what is the intent of Canadian content regulations or any kind of regulation of the airwaves? And then there's the, how has it been manifested?
Yeah.
And I think you've got, I can point out so many weird instances. Like, you know, I listened to you talk with Dave Thomas and he was pointing them out, and, you know, that comes up, where they're just weird Canadian content regulations that, the way that they were interpreted and executed are just kind of bizarre. I think the classic one, at least in terms of my generation, is when Bryan Adams was rejected for not being Canadian content enough. After when Waking Up the Neighbors came out, which was the album that came out after the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves soundtrack. You know, Everything I Do For You, the biggest song on the planet. And then Waking Up the Neighbors, which had that album on it, Can't Stop This Thing We Started, and I'm just very Bryan Adams literate because it's part of the citizenship requirements. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was produced by Butt Lang, you know, the Def Leppard guy, sure, who yeah. later on went to marry Shania Twain, and Canadian content. And it was recorded in England, and mm-hmm. by regulations, like, this isn't really Canadian content, because apart from Bryan Adams himself, most of these things don't meet the qualifications. Not Canadian producer, not Canadian studio, not mm-hmm. Canadian co-writer. It's just like, it doesn't meet that threshold. And people are like, but it's Bryan fucking Adams, you know, like, you know, point, counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. so it's like, all right, we need to sort of start thinking about this. But if we go back to why they're there, I mean, you know, we want to be thinking about airtime. We want to be thinking about all kinds of Canadian content regulations in terms of, the government is in the same thing in the States. The same reason there are regulations about that, if you have a broadcast license, you need to have a certain amount of public affairs program,
sure,
or
yeah.
your educational program or stuff. You know, you are using this resource, or we are giving you exclusive use of this particular resource, this megahertz at a particular time, and therefore you have obligations. You're basically doing it for free or for a nominal fee, mm-hmm. but therefore we require these sorts of things, including the content regulations that, you know, Carlin fought against so often,
sure.
hence the shift to cable. So it's like, in exchange for this, we ask that you do this more or less for the common good. And in Canada, you have to, it's self-evident, but you kind of have to remember that we are wedged between America and the United Kingdom. And mm-hmm. like when the CBC started, basically by taking a lot of material from the BBC, and it was almost a collaborative project that both crown corporations that do this. America didn't have a same kind of thing because the state doesn't interfere in the same sort of way. I mean, sure. that sort of, you know, radical distinction. It regulates, but it doesn't have, there's no state broadcast.
Right.
So, but the idea is that, no, you have to have a certain amount of, you're using this resource. You can't just use this resource to take material from other places, because you're getting into kind of abstract questions about, well, what is the nature, when we're talking about music, when we're talking about comedy, when we're talking about television, we're talking about movies, when we're talking about theater, because theater spaces work the same way when we start getting into granting mm-hmm. Agencies. It's like, well, what is the nature of art? What is the nature of art and its relationship to place?
Sure.
And, you know, do you want sort of the whatever Canadian fabric there is, do you want it to be washed out because all we're consuming is this American or British content, which is cheaper to produce because it's a larger corporate center, so it has more money at its disposal. So it's, mm-hmm. And it's also, you know, there's more American, so there's just more of it to have, and yeah. it's flashy and fine. And so we need an industry of our own in order to occasionally do these things that can only happen in Canada. If we didn't have Canadian content regulations, or one of the things is that it gets recorded in Canada, then when we start making Canadian stuff, we wouldn't have studios, because the studios wouldn't be able to subsist.
Mm-hmm.
So if we think about television, we have a lot of Canadian content that is things like RoboCop the series, or FX the series, or mm-hmm. the movie Porky's, moving over to cinema. That's Canadian content, because it was filmed with a crew, filmed on location, all this stuff. So basically providing the infrastructure so that when a Canadian thing happens that no one else would be interested in doing, we have a critical mass of trained people in order to do it.
Yeah.
You can argue that the state shouldn't have that interventionist quality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. And that's okay to make that argument. But since we do, it's like, this is kind of for the common good.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily stop one from, like, you know, pinching between your nose and going, but these are the consequences. This is how it has been manifest. So
yeah.
And this has come up because we have this issue about what happens when government is not simply saying you have these regulations, but you want to apply to the government in order to subsidize your theater, your festival, your movie studio, whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. your government grants are there. And, you know, American government grants work the same way. They might not be federal, they might be state mm-hmm. instead, but, you know, we have that infrastructure in place. It's like, it is a good thing that we have these sorts of things. And, but therefore, you know, if you have a theater, you need a certain amount of Canadian plays, because otherwise you're just going to be doing, you know, Broadway plays or obscure English plays or whatever. It's like, no. Now you have Canadian voices on Canadian stages as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think fundamentally that is a noble thing. Yeah. However poorly it might get manifested at times, it is sort of a noble endeavor. But right now, there's this organization called CASC, which is the Canadian Association of Stand-Up Comedy, or mm-hmm. Stand-Up Comedians. And the issue for them is, if you are a comedian and you want to apply for a grant in order to help subsidize your album, which fucking jazz musicians can get.
Mm-hmm.
If you're Canadian and you play jazz, you can get this. But if yep. you're a comedian, you can't. Or to subsidize your tour or something. It's like, basically, I want a little bit of money so that I can take time away from my day-to-day grind and live on as I am doing this thing.
Yeah.
Comedy is not recognized as an art form in that same kind of way. And when I say jazz, it's like, well, you know, you can make an argument that stand-up, often Canadian stand-up, is often talking about the Canadian situation.
Sure.
And is actually a feedback mechanism that does all those things that we talk about when we talk about sort of a functionalist idea of what comedy should be, and that it speaks truth to power, and sure. it represents marginalized voices, and all this sort of stuff that will be invoked when it is convenient to invoke it about comedy.
Sure.
Jazz is often instrumental in doing old standards and so on. And mm-hmm. I'm not pissing on jazz. I'm just saying that jazz doesn't necessarily represent Canadian voices anymore. So, but that is an art form that has a capital A on it, and it's mm-hmm. done in repertoires, and you need to have, you know, you need to have a certain amount of sort of, you know, conservatory training in order to do it, or,
sure.
or other people recognize you. The training for stand-ups are bars and coffee houses and so on. You know, I mean, and this is a point that I actually made in an article recently about, is stand-up comedy art, in that one of the things that one does is that you don't have a repertoire or a conservatory training.
Mm-hmm.
In order to do it, you do it in the kind of spaces where comedy takes place. And that is often in things that aren't much different from sitting around the kitchen table, going back to our first ideas. And so it is different from this. Now, if you're a standard comedian and you want to apply for something and you say, oh, I'm doing a one-person show. And so you're basically say, I'm not a comedian. This is a solo theater piece.
Yeah.
and a solo theater piece and stand-up are not the same fucking thing.
Right.
But that's what people will actively advise. Say, oh, sure, you can apply. You just need to put it in the context of a one-person show.
Mm-hmm.
A one-person show is where someone sits down and goes to their garret and writes an hour of material,
mm-hmm.
and then comes back and does something in front of an audience that is not exactly audience-dependent.
Yeah.
It is a monologue.
Sure.
And that's what it's, and it's like, oh, that's not how it's done. The composition and the of stand-up is maybe you go and sit down at a coffee shop and then you take it on stage and you work it out, you realize, oh, that didn't work, and you mm-hmm. go back. And that's why it's a collaborative medium, and that's why the work of it is done in these places until you have something that is tangible and workable. So the writing is not distinct from performance, really.
Yeah,
we know about Seinfeld, we know about Verbiglia, but even they are drafting and editing in two different spots.
Mm-hmm.
It's not playwriting, it's not theater. And so CASC, the organization, Association of Stand-Up Comedians, is basically trying to make the argument, no, comedians should be able to do this kind of thing if we purport that this is an important form of communication.
Sure.
And we will do so because we will subsidize comedy festivals, but
sure.
we're subsidizing the promoters and the venues, and only indirectly are comedians being paid that way. And they're mm-hmm. not—they're being paid to be there. They're not being paid to practice their craft in the same way that you can apply for, you know, 6 months in a writer's retreat.
Mm-hmm.
I need to go somewhere. Please pay for my writer's retreat for a couple months as I finish my novel. All right. No, it's difficult to argue. Please pay me so I can do a tour of dive bars in Northern Ontario for 3 weeks. But why not? We treasure the end product, but we do not really care for the process in which it's made because it is not particularly glamorous.
Yeah.
So CASC is kind of working in that way. And then they did stellar work during COVID in terms of like actually being a resource that people could go to when there was no actual work.
Mm-hmm.
Other artists had some kind of subsidies, comedians didn't, so this group really sort of took to the fore.
That's interesting.
So if you imagine the Canadian, go back to the Canadian content regulations, if you imagine that the art forms, even vulgar art forms, vulgar art forms like stand-up or commercial art forms like television, sitcoms, and so on, can be vehicles for expressing something that is in the public service of self-identification and so on. The government should perhaps make sure that the infrastructure for it should still be available, despite the fact that it might be more economically feasible just to, I'm just going to, you know, take a US Spotify list and
mm-hmm.
that's what my radio station is going to play. It's like, no, you've got to put on Canadian content. You have to create this art. We have to create the market for it
mm-hmm.
By putting it out there, and then people will come to it. And they do. And we have artists that no Americans hear of and are local superstars, and they have a living, which is a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a living not because they're simply sucking at the government teat, but because people actively go out. They might have started government teating,
mm-hmm.
but then it works on them. Again, there are problems. Much Music, the Canadian version of MTV, they hardly ever extend their interest beyond, you know, 5 square miles of Toronto. So it's just like, if you're in Toronto and you have a band, you could be an MTV regular. It's just mm-hmm. like there's a centrality of like Canada equals Vancouver, Montreal, Toronto, and that's it.
Yeah.
There are many problems with this system because, oh, it's Canadian. It's like, yeah, but there's so much of Canada that isn't being reflected in this. That's a similar, or at least a parallel problem to the weirdness of just like any old Canadian shit can go on. It's like,
yeah.
Not any old Canadian shit can go on. Still who you know. Anyway, end of rant.
No, it's complex, and I love knowing about it. And it's one of those things also that I was thinking about this the other day. This is maybe a total tangent, but any Canadian podcast I listen to, or anytime I hear a Canadian comic interviewed, there's a difference in terms of being perfectly willing. And I love this, by the way. There's a certain candor in how people are making their living if they are stand-ups on, like, my favorite podcast is Stop Podcasting Yourself, which is,
right.
If people haven't listened to that, is a Canadian show, is great. Co-stars Graham Clark, who is one of the funniest people, I think, on the planet. But whenever they'll interview people who come on, they're like, yeah, no, I'm a waitress. You know, this is how I make this. This is not to me. It seems antithetical because of how living in LA for 18 years, stand-ups will never talk about what they do for a day job until the mic's off.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's a Canadian thing or not, but it's a very honest thing, and something about it to me endears me to the comic and wants me to hear the material more. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't know. Again, that to me is Canadian content right there. Because I don't know. There's something about the honesty of it that I love.
Yeah. My friend Claire Belford just put out an album called The Whole Cabbage.
Uh-huh.
And on the album itself, she mm-hmm. talks about how she is a comedian and a waitress.
Yeah.
And like those are her two ways of actually earning a living. And like, mm-hmm. She goes back to being, this is what I do when I'm not on stage, which I don't get a huge amount of money for because I'm a Canadian comedian.
Right.
I am a waitress, which I also don't get a huge amount of money for. So, yeah, and that's a premise. And you're right. You don't see that kind of vicious honesty.
Yeah. Was she just on Stop Podcasting Yourself? Maybe she's who I'm thinking of.
She's been a couple of times.
Okay. Because
I don't know if it's been recent, but
I'm going to have to look.
Her album came out 2-3 weeks ago. So
okay, I think it was her. Now that you said that, I think it was she's the person I'm very much thinking of. It's in the immediate, but it happens a lot on that show specifically. If stand-up's about honesty, mm-hmm. there's no reason to not also carry that through to like your interviews or your other things. It's less posturing, as far as posturing can get you, which I know posturing can get you pretty far, but.
And it might be one of those strange Canadian humility things where it's just like, you know, everyone knows that I can't be like paying myself, you know, myself with what I'm earning in Canada. the most successful Canadians are basically comfortably middle class when mm-hmm. it comes to entertainment at best. There are mm-hmm. no superstars.
Yeah.
And the idea of like, there are full-time comedians, certainly, like, you know, you've got Ron James and you've got, the late Mike McDonald and so on, but for the mm-hmm. most part, they're doing something, and maybe if they're lucky, they're doing something like what the dream is in terms of US, in terms of writing gigs and so on.
Sure,
because there are some of those, but for the most part, they got day jobs. One of my good friends who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, Andrew Vaughn, mm-hmm. A Halifax-based comedian. He was an accountant, and mm-hmm. he didn't talk about accountancy a huge amount on stage. But yeah, that's what I do. I'm a filthy, vulgar comedian, but I can help you with your taxes and help you plan for your retirement.
It's interesting because again, you would I don't know, you Carlin is. It's so weird to me because as we're talking about this, Carlin is, you know, one of the most successful, well-known American comics of all time. And it's not like he was necessarily working a day job for any of that. However, you and I have been talking about things that he maybe wished he was doing instead a little bit, or mm-hmm. other parts of his life that are the things that he would never, ever have talked about. He, you know, there's no need to talk about, I'm doing this special because I just got out of rehab and necessarily, you know, he wouldn't have done that. That kind of honesty wasn't necessary to his work.
He doesn't talk about himself on stage at all. I mean, he will use the first person because that's how we tell stories. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there might be in some of those early albums, there might be a little bit of sort of playing around with reminiscences. But even then, they are halcyon. Absolutely. He's not talking about his struggles much. I'd say. I think on Carling and Carnegie, he says, because he was meant to record it, and then he had his second heart attack.
Yeah.
And then it was delayed a couple of months. But it was always intended to be at that. And I think at the beginning of the special, I haven't watched it in a little while, but beginning of the special, he says, you know, Richard Pryor and I both had heart attacks. And then Richard Pryor set himself on fire, and I said, fuck that, I'm just going to have another heart attack. And good line. Uh-huh. And then, again, confessional comedy over, and he's going back to his stuff. I think he was an intensely private person.
Yeah,
and that's fine. He was a very, and I mean, you probably know this from reading. He was very driven by these are the words that I want to say. He did not deviate. He did not ad lib. This is what was on stage, which is why his notes would be fascinating to get a hold of and see that, because talk a little bit about how in late interviews he talks about how he doesn't, but every now and then the audience might lead him in a different direction. So
okay.
He's probably the most non-responsive to an audience, which sounds very strange, but he's the most I know this works, and this is how I am going to say it. But even he recognizes the audience is playing something in the background.
So, for sure.
He's kind of fascinating guy. So that, yeah, I mean, that's why even his not successful albums are always interesting. And he, I mean, you know this, he's a figure. He needs to be reconciled with.
Yeah. Yeah,
It's difficult to imitate him. I don't know whether one should try to imitate him. I think many have tried, and it's a little bit, he's representative of such a broad arc of how comedy changed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And not saying he was the best, but he's just such a constant he needs to be engaged with. And this is a problematic album in that arc, and therefore at the very least it's of historical interest to people who pretend at least to take comedy seriously. And you don't have to love it,
sure,
but it needs to be grappled with, because when I suggested it, you were like, okay, sure.
No one's picked it, like nobody's fine. That's all I give a shit about. What would you give people as a starting point? I don't normally end it this way, but what is the album you would actually say start here with Carlin for? To love him or appreciate him in the way you do, maybe, if you're trying to get somebody else to get into it.
I still think that Class Clown is just about perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the obvious answer, unfortunately. Sure. I wish
no,
I had
fine.
Something.
No, there's not. There's a reason it was picked 10 times.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could do like the greatest hits album that came out in the late 70s, the George Carlin Collection or something, which covers that and has a, you know, it's the greatest hits. It's got a couple of things. And maybe you could argue that maybe there's a little bit of dead air on Class Clown, but for the most part, it is wonderful. FM and AM is hinting towards greatness, and its whole purpose is that it's transitional. It's like, cool, but you have to kind of care about what he's transitioning from and find it a historical artifact. Operation Fool has some wonderful things on it as well, and it's an interesting artifact in terms of how he is being cumulative. I mean, specifically in terms of talking more about his Roman Catholic background, more about the dirty words and so on. And that's where, Class Clown, it's the one that's enshrined in the Library of Congress.
Sure.
And there's sort of no arguing. It's the one that people will and clearly have constantly gone back to.
Mm-hmm.
They're all, even this one, they're all at the very least good.
Yeah.
Because there's no doubting how good he was at his craft. Even the later ones, which aren't necessarily fun, you recognize the artistry that's going and the mastery that he has over words and so on. I mean, they are beautiful aesthetic exercises in the marriage of idea and speech. They're just not necessarily fun. You don't put on later albums when you're in a good mood and want to keep that good mood going.
Right.
Because it's just like, this is about how all of culture is a distraction from the ulterior motives of crass capitalism and the ultimate destruction of the earth. It's like, cool. Let's go back to the Rice Krispies sketch on this one. Let's go back to Icebox Man. And let's go back to Place for My Stuff, which hints at crass commercialism.
Yes. Yeah.
But revels in it in an exciting, delightful way. It's a nice, wonderful marriage of, I think he's saying something about the human and specifically the American condition without making you feel like a piece of shit for participating in it. Place for My Stuff. I mean, I would put Place for My Stuff up against any of his routines. The track on that album.
Yeah.
Against any of his routines. It's probably as, I mean, maybe not as epochal, but as good as Seven Dirty Words. As good as many of the tracks in the early albums. It's a bright diamond in an otherwise bit of live and then sketches where it's like, okay, go back, Did you read his books, his brain droppings and
I
so on?
I did not. It was the people I didn't like growing up who liked those books. And I was like, did you ever listen to his fucking albums? Do you know what he's about at all? I would really question people who read them. Nothing against him or the books necessarily. I've never read them, so I can't say, but
yeah. Yeah, I have out of scholarly interest, but just like, there we go. Yeah, they're fine. Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Well, first of all, it's been a joy having you. Thank you for doing the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Where can people find you? What would you like to promote, bearing in mind this won't come out for about a month?
Okay.
Unless you have something urgent, in which case I can push it.
I don't really. I mean, I'm an academic, so I really don't have urgent things. Sure. The only big news is that I'm on a podcast coming out fairly soon. I think in about a month. I'm on Twitter at avulgarart, and I have a website which I occasionally add things to at avulgarart.com. I just got those things as promotion for the book, but it's a nice bit of branding. And you can, I mean, there's links to sort of Instagram if you like pictures of Cape Breton. I do that every now and then. My book is through University of Mississippi Press. Support presses as best you can, but it's clearly available on Amazon as well. And everything else is I can't really promote because I'm still in the process of writing it and behind deadlines and so on. But I'm not really in a promotion field, but follow me and buy my book, and therefore my people who I work for will say, hey, people are buying this book, and they'll get promoted in that kind of way.
So, right.
Yay. Support your local academic.
Thank you so much for doing the show.
Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs, and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15-plus years. Stolen Dress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!